This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got two sponsors, the first being our good friends at Jam Software, makers of the Casper Suite device management server for Macs and iOS. We'll tell you more about that as the show goes on. And we're also sponsored by the book Stop Getting IT Wrong, which is an interesting collection of musings, whingings, and strategies about the successful use of technology in any classroom. We'll talk a little bit more about that later too. Good evening, Bradley. Happy iOS 7 week.
It's a big week. It was funny yesterday. Of course, I was running the Gold Master on both my devices, so it kind of wasn't as exciting, that aspect. But just watching all the app updates, and you're just kind of like wondering, like, who's coming through the door next? Because, you know, a lot of those I didn't know about. So Evernote was the big one that was surprising.
Yes, I did not expect that either. It was definitely a fun few hours just watching those updates roll in. What do you think of the new Evernote?
I am a big fan. Of course, I was okay with version 5, particularly on the iPhone. I know a lot of people had strong comments about it, but I had gotten used to it. But I had an inkling something was coming. For two reasons. Number one, I'm on the beta for the Evernote iOS apps, and it had been bone quiet for months, really for the past 3 months. Like, there had been no new updates. And then at the WWDC keynote, the event last 2 weeks ago or whenever it was. Yeah, the iPhone event. They had a screenshot that I happened to catch that showed an Evernote iPhone app that I had not seen before. So I started having an inkling about it. And I talked to a good friend, Federico Vitici, over at Mac Stories, and he's also on the beta and was kind of like, hey, have you heard anything? And I haven't heard anything. So just putting all that together, we realized that something big must be happening.
Yeah, I'm very pleased with that. I had not been a big fan of the version 5 generation of Evernote apps. I mean, I think they were definitely, at least on iOS, were better than the version 3 generation, but I think they were very much a kind of intermediate form leading up to something better, and I think what they've done for iOS 7 is really interesting. But I think maybe before we get into what our favorite iOS 7 apps, I mean, what do you think about iOS 7 overall? What's your take on the release?
When I first started out, I guess on beta 4, I wasn't sold in the beginning. But of course, you don't know in those situations, is it because it's slow and your apps are crashing?
Yeah.
But having used it since beta 4, let's put it this way. Every time I had to use my wife's iPhone or iPad, it just felt so dated. So I'm a big fan overall. New mail is absolutely fantastic. New messages is great. Safari is great. Not sold on the calendar app. I just kind of feel like it's hard to get around, but I use Fantastical anyway. So
okay.
So yeah, what did you think?
Yeah, I think overall I'm a fan. I think the message that a lot of reviewers have been putting out this week is you've got to give it some time to get used to it. And it's a fairly surprising way to, you know, have wake up one morning and your phone looks like that compared to what it was before. I mean, the difference between iOS 6 and 7 is pretty stark. But I agree with you that, you know, once you go back to working on an iOS 6 device, it feels like a piece of history. I'm not one of those people who is down on iOS 6 and, you know, makes fun of the textures and so on. I think iOS 6 did, and previous versions of iOS did, a really important job at a really important time, both for Apple and just for the mobile industry as a whole. But I think it is time to move on, and partly that's because so many people have already figured out how to use touchscreen devices that they don't need that kind of support anymore, and they can start to appreciate some of the more, I want to say, pure touch design, but I don't know if that's quite the right phrase. But, you know, it's certainly another take on how you interact with a mobile device. And I'm a big fan of the overall style. I think there are some rough corners. And I think my least favorite thing that has happened in iOS 7 is the new folder layout on iPad, where instead of having a grid of 20 icons that you could get to with one tap, you've now got a 3x3 grid right in the middle of a gigantic screen, and then you can page another 9 across and another 9 across. It seems like a huge waste of space, and I hope they reconsider the square layout of the folder. But apart from that, that's what I think is the most egregious form over function change. But in general, I'm really happy with it. Like you said, the Mail app is dramatically better for searching. That was the one thing that I really noticed. I mean, I've always had Mail for writing email, and then keeping the Gmail app on my devices as well, just so I could search quickly. Now, it's not as fast as the Gmail app itself, but it's way, way faster to search through back emails than it was before. So overall, I'm pretty happy.
Well, that probably is my chief complaint as well. I had a draft blog post that I ended up not posting just because I felt like everything had been said. The two things that I didn't like was the folders. I just felt like that there was a lot of wasted spaces, particularly on the iPad, as you mentioned. But I could see that changing in iOS 7.1 or 7.0.2. It feels like something they probably... the code worked from the iPhone and didn't have time to maybe expand it, because that works on the iPhone, the amount of icons on the screen, but on the iPad it just doesn't.
Oh yeah, it makes sense on the phone, but it just in a lot of ways, Bradley, I think there's a lot of things on the iPad where okay, it works and it's clearly just a scaled version of the phone design, but there's more optimization could be done for some of that stuff, I think.
I look at iOS 7, like this version of it, a lot like, I guess, this is before my Mac time because I came on in the Panther era. But I imagine maybe this is how people felt about the original Mac OS 10. It's like, okay, some of this, it works and we can see where they're going, but we're going to have to just hang on and get some of these little quirks worked out over time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just hoping that the refinement happens fast. And what I mean by that is I don't want it to be that this is what we've got for a year, and then next year we get the first set of refinements, and then the year after that we get the next set. I hope that some of those refinements will find their way into point releases pretty quickly. And I certainly hope that that's true.
You know, my other kind of complaint is I'm very confused. Not confused because I figured it out, but Safari, when I scroll and it goes to full screen, then I lose my toolbar, to go back. And I often am not sure, what to do to get that back. It feels like if I have to start, scrolling back up to get that back. And I just, think, that's confusing. Why would I need to scroll up to get my toolbar back? I don't know.
Yeah, there's not really an obvious gesture to get the bottom bar to come back up. In other apps, it's always been you tap in sort of the center of the content to bring the toolbars back. But that doesn't always quite work in Safari exactly, so... that definitely confused me for a while as well. I think, the first time I tried iOS 7 was, I think, beta 3. And I think it has changed a little bit since then, its exact behavior. But I haven't quite got in my head exactly what and why makes those toolbars come back up just yet.
So I'm going to tell a funny story on myself. And I like to consider myself somewhat of an iOS quote-unquote expert. I would like to think that I know what I'm doing with iOS because I've used it for a long time. And I thought that my phone, the software was hosed, because it felt like that my notifications weren't popping up, for messages and mail. And I would be maybe reading an Instapaper. I would go back to the home screen. I would have multiple emails and multiple messages. I'm thinking, where are these notifications from? And so I just didn't have any idea. I would hard reboot the phone. I would turn the notifications on and off in notification center or the settings for it. It just had no clue. And then last night I realized it, because I was close from restoring to the release edition and not restoring from a backup, just going cold turkey, which is a pain, especially when you've got services that have two-factor authentication, because it's not as simple as just copying the passcode from one password and pasting it. You know, stuff all your Gmail accounts on the Mail account, you have to log in and create two-factor or application-specific passwords, and it's just a pain. So the setting that got me was Do Not Disturb. Because my schedule is from 9 into 7, but I'm gonna tell a little I guess funny story on myself. Couple friends of mine, we have a bad habit of passing around GIFs to each other, just random times of the day. I'm sure other people do that as well. We'll just we'll just, you know, rib on each other throughout the day. And a lot of that time, it's like literally before 7 and after 9, mainly because we all have young kids, so we're all up just keeping each other company. And I realized the setting that got me was inside of Do Not Disturb, there's a new setting that says silence always or silence only when the phone is locked. And that's new to iOS 7, and it was on always. And so every time after 9 o'clock, even if I was on the phone, it was silencing the notification.
Yeah, that's a nice addition, but potentially confusing as you have found out. There's just so many tiny little tweaks in iOS 7 that are really nice like that. I have appreciated a few of them. In particular, the one my favorite one of all is in Control Center, where you can turn the flashlight on. When iOS apps first came out that were flashlights based on the screen brightness, we used to make fun of them so hard, but I literally use that every day of my life. Going to bed, trying not to disturb my wife, or going into the kids or something like that. It's always just flashlight on the phone. So it's good to see that becoming a first-class citizen feature of the platform.
Yeah, Control Center is great. I use it daily. The only thing I don't like about it is let me set this up. Like, we have multiple Apple TVs in our house, and so we're doing a lot of AirPlay, like music and whatnot. Well, like in the music app, it doesn't have the AirPlay button anymore. You have to use Control Center to AirPlay music, okay. Which seems confusing to me.
Yeah, it's you've got to remember where it is now rather than having it right in front of you. Yeah.
So, but I got it on my wife's iPad and iPhone last night, and Chris, she knows all about it, and I've showed it to her, and I said, "Well, what do you think?" And she's like, "Oh, it's fine." It's like, you don't have any more to say about it? Like, you don't love it? Like, I'd almost rather somebody hate it than have no opinion.
My wife won't let me update her iPhone yet.
Well, I think it's kind of a sobering reminder of, like, regular people, their phone is whatever their app they're in. So if, like, the app she's using to track my son's, like, 5,000 medicines that he's taking for his stomach issues isn't updated kind of to an iOS 7 look, then she doesn't care.
Yeah.
We got our iPad and our iPhone. So I did my husbandly duty for the night and took care of our stuff, and we're good to go.
Excellent. I think it's going to be an interesting release. It's going to be good fun. A lot of apps have been updated for iOS 7 already, and I think Evernote's a big one that we've been on the record as being big Evernote fans for a while. But I think, more broadly, it's been very interesting to me already how some of the big developers have really taken advantage of some platform features straight away. I was not really expecting quite as much as they've done. And I think in the main, Bradley, the one that gets me is how people have adopted the background updates very quickly. So Evernote 7, if I sync a new note on my Mac, it's going to get pushed to all my devices straight away. Have you noticed any other good examples of that?
I think, of course, I've got Pocket Casts, and I'm using that for the moment for podcasts, and it's been nice. Like, I don't have to check it. I don't have to sync before I leave work. It just, like, periodically syncs throughout the day, and when I'm on Wi-Fi, it just downloads automatically, which I love. And I love this background upgrade or background update API. But I think it's going to take some education to, again, regular people. Because one of the things that you did a couple years ago is, I don't know how you ran a test, but you showed where leaving apps in the multitasking tray did not affect, basically did not use kind of cycles. Once they were closed, they kind of were frozen.
Yeah.
But I don't think people believed IT people when we said you don't have to close applications. You can just, the operating system handles that. And so I've had two people in the past 2 days come to me. One person texted me this morning. They said, "How do I close apps in the multitasking tray?" And I said, "Well, you swipe up, but you don't have to. And the reason you might not want to is if they're not there, then they can't update." And he said, "Well, my son has 10 games, open." I said, "Well, you can close those, but, things like things like Evernote, you want to leave those open because, and correct me if I'm wrong, if they're not in the multitasking tray, then, like, they can't get background updates. Is that correct?"
That's my understanding of it, yeah.
So, yeah, but overall, I think it may take some re-education, but overall, that feature I think is going to be great because it'll allow your phone to feel faster. So, if you add something to Evernote, then you say you get on a train, you late in the afternoon, you forgot to open Evernote to sync and get your latest PDFs that you emailed yourself. The edit shouldn't happen anymore. They should just be there.
Yeah, it's been something that's kind of been lacking in iOS for a while is that idea. I mean, the one place that I always caught it, Bradley, was when using Wunderlist, a to-do list manager, it's got reminders. But if I set up all those reminders on my Mac and then I don't open the app on my phone under iOS 6, well, I don't get the reminder on my phone, which is pretty useless. But now, well, I don't think Wunderlist have updated yet, but assume they do, that will no longer be a problem.
And the same thing with Evernote reminders as well.
Exactly, yep. And I've seen a couple of other good examples of this. One is Pocket, which is the kind of big competitor to Instapaper. They now have a feature. You have to, in Pocket, you have to explicitly turn it on in their settings. But once you do, when you add something to Pocket, say through your desktop browser, it gets pushed to your devices in the background and it's there for you when you open up the app, which is really nice.
Yeah, those style apps are very helpful for that because one of the features of them is they can be offline. Of course, a lot of our lives are, you know, quote unquote online, but because I don't know about you, but my iPad is Wi-Fi only, so I do have periods where my iPad is not on any sort of network connectivity. So it would be great if, you know, Instapaper Pocket could download those automatically. I'm back on Instapaper for the moment, and they did have an update yesterday, but it was mainly just an interface. They've been, you know, busy. They had a new website that came out since they bought it from Marco Arment, and talked to one of their employees yesterday at BetaWorks, and they said they should have some 5.1 out within the month that will have those iOS 7 features. So, Pocket, that was a great update, and their interface is slick. Going back to Wunderlist, it'll be interesting what they do to their design because it is pretty skeuomorphic, and so it'll be interesting.
They're very texture heavy, aren't they? Yeah.
I'm still using the app, and you know, it really, really works out well for me. I don't love, I guess, the look of it. I can kind of do without the skeuomorphic, but you know, especially looking at the OmniFocus 2 update, which I've heard, you know, somewhat mixed review of, and I Wunderlist seems to be going to stay on my home screen for now.
Do you know what one app I really like in iOS 7 that's built in is the Reminders app? I think it's an absolutely beautiful redesign of that app. Just it has a kind of feel of Passbook with the little cars jumping up for different lists. I just thought that was a really, really nicely done first-party redesign. One other example of that background updating that was really interesting is the Kindle app also supports it now. So when you buy a book on the website, whether through your phone or whether through a desktop computer, if you send it to, because when you buy a Kindle book, you send it to one specific device registered to your account. If you're on the device that you send it to, as soon as you hit, even before you hit that button that says go to Kindle for iPhone, the Kindle app has already been notified in the background and is downloading your book, which is really nice as well. Because, you know, many times I've bought a book on the way out the door and then forgot to actually open the app to download it, and then you've got to, you know, get on your 3G if you can or whatever. And if you don't have a 3G iPad, for example, like you don't, Bradley, that's another issue. Because I remember I was just going to say that a friend of mine, when I had a Nexus 7 and it was Wi-Fi only, I was complaining about it to a friend who also had one. He said, well, see, the thing with Android is that because most of these apps are running in the background, whenever you kind of go into a Wi-Fi zone, all the apps sort of update themselves anyway, and then you move on again. So they tend to be updated by the time you get there. And I was kind of bemoaning that fact a little bit because I hadn't really set it up that way. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of affects our lives as iOS users. I think it'll be an improvement.
So I guess iBooks already has it. Stuff.
Sorry,
I guess iBooks already has that built in through iCloud, the automatic downloads. Correct? That's how that works, right? Like, it automatically downloads it, I guess.
Well, that's a good question.
Let's look in the settings.
I think the answer is that it will automatically show up with the cloud icon over it, but then you would have to initiate the download unless you're actually buying it on the device. I mean, obviously, if you buy it on the device, it will just download directly to your library.
In the store settings, it says automatic downloads, music apps, books, and updates. And I've got books and updates on. So,
okay.
I don't know. I found it interesting, and I've heard mixed.
I've never bought an iBook through iTunes, so I've never tried that path.
So you're a Kindle guy, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty much 100% Kindle, except for the few multi-touch books that I have.
So, just curious, how come? Just because they were there first?
Yeah, I mean, I bought one of the first international edition Kindles that were ever available, which was basically the Kindle 2 that Amazon had sold in the US, and then they basically said, well, okay, now you can buy it in the UK, but basically it was shipped from the US, and you had to buy books on the US store, but you could have it in the UK. And I had that. I bought that as pretty much as soon as it was available, so I guess I've just always been in that line. But also in the UK, the iBook store is typically more expensive and has less of a selection than the Kindle store. It hasn't caught up. It's not at parity yet, I wouldn't say.
That's interesting, because I've heard the exact opposite for things like movies and TV shows, that iTunes has more
that is than true. Say, yeah.
It's interesting. I guess it just kind of, you often feel like outside of like iBooks author stuff that Apple does books because they have to.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's something that's there, and, you know, I guess they hoped they could persuade publishers to be friends with them. We know how that worked out. But, yeah, I mean, I like iBooks, and I would really like to use iBooks. I prefer the iBooks app. I prefer the whole buying experience on iBooks, but, you know, I'm not paying the premium just for that. And also, I've got a hardware Kindle as well, so I just want to keep it all in one system. And the Kindle app on the iPad is fine. It's not as nice as iBooks, but it's fine.
Before we move on, let's go ahead and take a break for our first sponsor. We're talking about the Stop Getting IT Wrong book. Now, they've sponsored podcast for the past couple weeks now, and again, this is a really, really inexpensive store on the Amazon store. Oddly enough, it's actually not even on the iBook store just yet. It's at stopgettingitwrong.com. So it's a book about basically using technology in the classroom. It's written by a teacher, and basically just has like great stories that, you know, of actually, you know, using technology in the classroom, and not just like a technology classroom, but like, you know, using digital technology in any classroom at any level, whether it be computer science, dance, history, English. There's something in this book to help you teach smarter. You know, I don't know about you guys, Fraser, but one of the things we kind of preach at our school is that technology is just a way to engage the curriculum, that our curriculum is the key. So our goal is not really just to teach technology, but to integrate technology in every subject we do. Just how, you know, you do writing in science and history and English, we want to use technology in science and history and English. So it collects best practices of over 7 years in teaching with computers and digital technology every day, brought to you by a passionate teacher who genuinely believes that every lesson can be made better just by using technology we already have at our fingertips. Stop Getting IT Wrong is available from Amazon as a paperback for £9.99 in pounds or $13.38 in US dollars. So there's that whole pound dollar conversion again. Or £3 for the Kindle, and that's basically $4.66 in Kindle. The iBook store is coming soon. Stopgettingitwrong.com. I actually love the website too. Like, I usually kind of hate book websites, mm-hmm. but this, his website, it's actually really, really good. So even if you don't buy it, go check out the website, stopgettingitwrong.com. So thanks to them for sponsoring the show this week.
Okay. So for our professional lives, Bradley, what kind of things do we get in iOS 7 that are important to schools?
Well, you know, you and I both have blogged off of this, and I basically linked back to your blog this morning, and I know some other folks linked to yesterday, is the web filtering in Safari, which answers, as you mentioned, answered the question of how do you kind of tell parents to protect your student devices when they're at home. So do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is a feature that was it certainly wasn't widely reported at all. I had known about it from the beta program for a while, but obviously couldn't really say anything about it. Basically what it is it's a built-in web filter that runs on the device. And what it does is it filters network requests at a very low level so that any application, because Apple only allows you to use the WebKit browser component in your application, they don't let you run alternative rendering engines for HTML. So everybody has to have a WebKit browser. And then what it does is it filters below that level through an API called NSURL Connection, which is the way that you download URLs on an iOS device or a Mac. And what they've done is they've basically put a filter in at that point so that when it's turned on, if you make a URL request for something that is considered inappropriate, that will be blocked and the system will return you back an HTML page saying that URL is filtered. And you then have, at least if you set it up through restrictions on the device, you get a little link that you can tap that asks for the PIN code, and then you can allow that website to be accessed instead. I have turned this on, and I have found it to be really quite zealous. and the irony of the whole thing was that the first website I realized was blocked by the auto filter was in fact my own blog. So that was, proving the point, I suppose. As far as I can tell, there's basically three controls, right? So let's lay out what you can do. You can turn on the filter, and this is done either in settings, restrictions, websites, it's called, and you can turn it on the device manually, or you can set it via configuration profile. If you want to set it via configuration profile, your device has to be supervised. You can turn it on manually for any device, supervised or not, but if you want to do it through a profile, it's got to be supervised. Now, you can say, turn on the filter, yes or no, and then you have the option to have a blacklist and a whitelist. So things that are filtered, but if they're in the whitelist, you'll be allowed, and if they're not filtered, but they're in the blacklist, you'll be denied. But what, as far as I can tell, there's no documentation I've seen yet, and there's no control over how the auto filter works. It's not clear to me whether the rules are built into the operating system or whether the rules are periodically downloaded from an Apple server or how they're updated or anything like that. There's no controls you can put on. There's no categories you can choose to allow or disallow. It's just filter yes or no. And so far, I've certainly bumped into the filter two or three times at points when I would not have expected to have those URLs filtered before. So it's not clear to me on what criteria. The interface in settings states, it says limit access to adult websites, but then I don't think my blog is really an adult website. And I also found the Guardian website blocked as well for some reason, or at least certain URLs on the Guardian website. So it's not clear how that's controlled, but you know, it'll be interesting to see how that evolves and whether or not those the sort of rationale for how it works is documented at some point or not. I have tried to implement it for some students in our school who are upgrading to iOS 7 just to see how it goes. I'm asking for their feedback at the moment, but I can always undo that again if I need to. And I think in its current form I might need to undo that. But the beauty of it is that it filters Safari, it filters third-party browsers, so it filters Chrome, it filters Dolphin, it filters any third-party browser. It also filters embedded web views inside other apps. Now, I don't know about you, Bradley, but some schools have implemented policies that say if an app has an embedded web view, that app basically can't be used because it can't really be filtered. We haven't had that policy. And I don't think it's a very good policy, but some schools have had it. And I think if you can turn on the filter, then you can certainly relax that policy going forward. I don't know if you've tried it. Have you looked at the settings for it?
I have briefly looked at it. I hadn't had a chance to turn it on and play with it. But I'll tell you, I kind of, after seeing your tweet about the Guardian website being blocked, it kind of got me thinking that in some ways, an overzealous filter is more distracting than no filter.
Yeah. The way I look at that is I just feel like this is going to be a lot of work for me, because I feel like we've got our network filters at a point where they're pretty well tuned so that people don't run into them accidentally, but when people do step outside the lines, they do get caught. So I feel like you need to understand the filter, and it's hard to understand this one because there's basically no controls over it. It's just on or off. So we'll see how that goes.
And most filters that you or I are going to deploy are going to have kind of management controls where you could kind of select categories because, you know, I may need to be more strict at my school than you do. And of course, then maybe Apple's not looking to basically do what we're intending this to do. But maybe they are. Maybe this is just kind of the first iteration. This is where, like, in about a month, it'd be great to call up your local Apple systems engineer and it's like, hey, let's talk about this feature. How can we make this better? And where are you guys headed with this?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, if you never turn it on, you don't know what to say in that conversation. So it's worth getting some experience about it as well.
So, no, I think if it will do what we think we want it to do long term, I think that'll be a great solution to parents. I know my headmaster linked to my blog that was linking to your blog and basically sent it to all of our families because we get to ask that question often. Like, how do I protect my kids, you know, iPhones or iPads when they're off, you know, our home network or when they're off our school campus and, you know, they're filtered? Yeah. You know, as I say, boys will be boys.
Yeah, because this kind of feels like one of the emerging questions in sort of one-to-one deployments where kids take the device home. Like, we can control the school network, we control the home network now, we're getting that message across, but then there's all these other networks as well. And, you know, and to me, it's still a fair question as to what extent is that our problem? Because, you know, at some level, you have to look at the reality of the world, which is that, you know, networking is essentially available everywhere. You can go to McDonald's and get on the network or wherever. So I still firmly believe that education is much more important than prevention. But at some level, you know, if you have, it may even be a thing where you don't necessarily put this on for every pupil. But if some parent phones you up and goes, I demand that you do something about this, then you can say, well, okay, here's the web filter, right? Which is, you know, it's going to be a pretty terrible experience because it's incredibly zealous, but okay, we'll turn it on. And don't come complaining to me when your kid can't use the internet for schoolwork because you asked me to put the filter on. So it's a wee bit like having the camera restriction. It's something to keep in your back pocket if you need it one day as well. That's probably how I may end up using it. But I am deploying it. I have in Casper, I've got a rule that says I've got a profile for this, and I'm saying any device that comes into the iOS 7 scope, which is a smart group for only iOS 7 devices belonging to kids, anybody who upgrades to iOS 7 gets pushed that configuration profile straight away. So we're going to get some experience on that, and we'll report back and see how that goes. See how long it lasts before I have to take it off again.
What's your timeline like for kind of doing this on not just a kind of a beta test, but, you know, making sure that 100% of your school is iOS 7? Or do you have a timeline?
I don't have a specific timeline. What's happened is that obviously because the iOS updates come in through system preferences and or settings. You know, that's my Mac heritage shining through there. There's nothing you can do to stop it, right? If kids press the button, they press the button and they get the update. So what I have done is that I tested it today with a couple of kids. I set my class in exercise and I said, whoever's finished first gets to be the first person to upgrade to iOS 7. So you've never seen work done so quickly in your life. If only there was an OS update every day. But so we did that. We checked that there was, you know, the procedure was fine. I mean, obviously I had done my devices through iTunes based on the beta program, but just to make sure the over-the-air updates were fine, that all worked. So we just started kind of rolling through as kids came into my class. You know, we would start to update them and so on. That kind of killed our network. By the end of the day, everybody was... Everybody was showing like 6 hours remaining for iOS updates. So there's no specific plan for the secondary kids. I basically said, look, make sure your iCloud backup's up to date, then just go ahead and do it. And it seems to be working fine for most kids. For the younger kids who have the institutional deployment, what I'm doing for them is in their maintenance period every week, I'm going to update their devices. So I'll do one class. It takes a long time, so one class this week, one class the next week, and so on. So I'm just testing that with a few of those devices to start with, but it seems to be okay.
I'm thinking I'm going to wait probably maybe a month. I know like one of our key apps actually had an update last week that enabled iOS 7 support. It just didn't say it. Once I pinged their support, they told me that, hey, good to go. But I'm thinking there'll probably be a new version of Apple Configurator right around the corner. And so I'm hoping some of those kind of like some of the stuff that we'll talk about later with that the Casper suite added, the support, I'm thinking those will probably come back to Configurator. So I'd kind of love to do that and maybe update our profiles some, tweak them, and just kind of do it all. And same thing, we kind of have a maintenance period on Fridays and kind of try to like do one a one set a day kind of thing, one set of Friday, make sure everything goes well, make sure no key apps were broken that I wasn't aware of, and then kind of go from there. You know, another thing too, since I will be doing these all myself, I have a feeling that 7.0.1 will probably be out soon, or actually I'm sure it'll be 7.0.2 because there was already a .1 for the 5C and 5S. And so I just have a feeling that'll probably be out within 2 weeks, and so I'd love to like have my update be that and not the 7.0.
Yeah, because you're eventually going to end up doing a few rounds of this. I'm starting with, doing it through Apple Configurator, I'm starting with the very youngest kids in the school because they basically don't have any important data on their devices. They just have apps. And if I had to, for example, wipe all their devices and start again, it would not be the end of the world. So I'm testing that just now. But yeah, we are specifically looking at getting everything onto iOS 7 in fairly short order. We're in no way are we planning to be iOS 6 holdouts at all, because what's the point? We just bought all these new devices. What's the point in hanging on to the past with software? There was one thing I was going to say about that, which was kind of lost my train of thought there a little bit. What I was going to say was it's quite interesting, isn't it, that there have not been any updates to Apple apps apart from the ones that come delivered with the OS. So there's been no iWork updates, no iLife updates. Find My Friends is even the same as it was before. I wonder what's going on with that.
I think Find My Friends has a new icon there's a new icon. I guess it's kind of brighter, but okay. It came out maybe 2 weeks ago. The only one that has been updated is the Apple Store app. Which I don't have that installed, but yeah, the iTunes Connect app is not been updated. The Keynote remote is still not even optimized for the iPhone 5, and you just feel like that the guy that maybe like built that like left, and no one knows where the original files are.
There is a whiff of that. Yeah. I used that quite a lot in my South African trip last week, and it was noticeable that it did not stretched to the full height of the iPhone 5 screen.
Yeah, somebody asked me about that today. They said, why is iWork not been updated? And I said, they just didn't get to it. I mean, that's kind of Apple's mantra. Rather than rush it out, they're just, hey, well, maybe they'll have something ready in October. Maybe it's in November. Maybe it's in February. But, especially something like a productivity suite, you'd rather stay on, have it work than them half release something.
Seem to work as well. There's not anything obviously broken in any of these apps under iOS 7, so that's fine. I mean, historically, Apple has tended to introduce an iPad alongside some major new iLife or iWork application. I mean, obviously, the three iWork apps came out with the first iPad, and then the second one had GarageBand, and then the third one had was it GarageBand and iMovie together, and then iPhoto came out with the Retina iPad. Be interesting to see what else they might do, whether it's just updates or maybe one new app or something like that.
Of course, now iWork and iMovie or iPhoto are all free.
Yeah, yep. Free to new iOS customers, which is a kind of caveat that's not entirely clear what that means just yet, but it'll be interesting to see how that rolls out.
Yeah, because of course I already own all those, but like I had a friend complaining, like iWork, he's on iOS 7. He says iWork's still saying it costs money, and of course I had read on Macworld where it was any iOS 7 device and not just new devices. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it might even be like new Apple IDs. I'm talking off the top of my head here. I don't know what it really is, but you know how when you when you set up a new device with a new Apple ID, you go into the App Store and it says, would you like to download iTunes U, iBooks, IM, Find My Friends, and all that stuff. And you say yes, and you get a download of like 5 podcasts is another one, and Find My iPhone. And I think the way it's working is basically that the iLife and iWork applications are in there, and they offer to download those for you as well.
Which I don't understand, because like, why would you... Why give them free to new customers and not to existing customers that can just make new Apple IDs?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's some revenue thing in there. There's maybe some accounting issue with that. I'm not sure.
True.
Probably. It's always lawyers, isn't it?
True, yeah.
And accountants.
So remember when the iPod Touch updates would cost $10 and back in the day? And then mm-hmm. Do you remember when some Mac came with 802.11n, the chip, but it wasn't enabled, and they sold an enabler for $2?
Yeah, that was one of the PowerBooks, wasn't it? And then, of course, the first FaceTime was also like 50p or something, yeah.
Yeah, lawyers.
Rules.
So do you want to talk about, during our next sponsor, we'll talk about the Casper 9.1?
Yeah, let's talk.
All right, well, oddly enough, it's kind of perfect timing. Our sponsor, again, this week is Jamp Software, the makers of the great Casper Suite. They provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in education organizations. Now, this is a company that's focused on Apple. That's their bread and butter. They're not a company that focuses on BlackBerry and Windows, and they do Apple stuff on the side. So if you're looking for MDM solutions for the Apple products, this is where you want to go. And they have a great software portion called Casper Focus that places these powerful technologies directly into the hands of the teachers. So not the IT staff doesn't have to do everything. Casper Focus allows the teacher to keep the students on a certain activity. And so they're using their iOS device in the way it was intended. Again, it's very, very easy to use. The teacher does it, not the IT staff. And we'll talk about more about Casper 9.1 later. But if you're not a Casper customer, go to jampsoftware.com, jamfsoftware.com. Again, both of our sponsors' links to their sites will be in the show notes at outofschool.net.
Yeah, so Casper, I've been spending a little time with our Casper installation this week, obviously. I was very pleased that they had an update for the whole suite, basically that shipped on the same day as iOS 7. So they had Casper 9.1. We, as we discussed, back in August, we shipped on day one of our term running Casper 9.0, which was quite new at the time. And then 9.1 came out just alongside iOS 7. And what 9.1 has got in it is basically support for all of these new configuration options in iOS 7. So they've got interface there to build a configuration payload for the web filter, for example. They've also got ones for things like the new AirPlay destination stuff, which is quite interesting. We haven't mentioned that yet. So they were up and running pretty much straight away. And one of the things they highlight in the sponsor read that we do is Casper Focus. And Casper Focus is an app that runs on teacher devices that allows teachers to... In its first iteration, what it let teachers do was clear passcodes on devices in their class, and also to basically start single app mode on a device in a particular app. So what they've done is they've actually enhanced it a little bit with 9.1. They've updated the app, and they've also put in some new capabilities where if you have your Apple TVs under MDM control, which is a thing you can do now as well, the teacher can take a device in their class and an Apple TV that they have control over, and they can remotely start an AirPlay session from that device to that Apple TV, which is a pretty cool feature because, we've sort of done this verbally in class up till now where we say, you over there, put your screen up there. And some kids find that easier than others. And occasionally what happens is that some kids will pick their own TV and they end up putting their screen on another classroom. So with Casper Focus, a teacher can actually do that for them, which might be even better for younger kids. But you can also now enroll your Apple TVs in MDM, which is quite interesting. Go ahead.
It does take up a license, as I think you talked to them on Twitter.
Yeah, they are. Obviously, Casper is charged per seat, so you end up paying it's like £5 a year for every Apple TV that you want to put in it as well, which... You know, I think over time that's going to be a better value. At the moment, with the current stuff that Apple TVs can be set to do over MDM, that feels like okay, but I don't really see that I'm getting the value out of that. But I think over time, Apple TVs will just get more capable of being more deeply controlled over MDM. So I think, you know, in a year's time, 2 years' time, it'll be a no-brainer that you put all your Apple TVs in MDM. Today, there's a few things you can do with it. So that's where that is. But I don't think the Apple TV software update is out yet that enables that to happen. So I'm still waiting to test that out.
Yeah, I tried to upload. You know, for some reason that seems to take forever, the Apple TV updates, and I'm leaving. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But I always like will do it like when I get home from work when they're out, and then my wife wants to watch something, and it takes 30 minutes. She's like, do we need to do this now? What's new about it? I don't even know. But I tried to update one this morning, and it said no software update. But you really feel like the Apple TV with some of these features is becoming, you know, not just kind of this home product that we're integrating into our school as much as it is like a natural accessory for your iPad deployments.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly some people who talk about Apple TV as if it's essential in the classroom. And it's, I mean, I'm not saying it's trivial. It's not. It's a very important part of the ecosystem. We've found them to be pretty useful. We've got one in just about every classroom in the school now. I think there's just one classroom that doesn't have it still. But, you know, whenever we put in a new TV panel or a new projector, we put in an Apple TV on it as well. No question about it.
Do you put those on Wi-Fi or do you hardwire them in?
It depends on the layout of the room. So if I can, I'll hardwire it. But if I can't, I'll just put it on Wi-Fi. And I have not noticed a huge amount of performance complaints with people having it on Wi-Fi. So, you know, from time to time, I'll wire them in if I can.
Well, I've heard that the network processor in the Apple TVs is not the best. And again, when it's a $100 device, I mean, they have to kind of cut corners somewhere. I'll typically try to wire things like that in just to try to eliminate one other thing on the network. But again, obviously, it has Wi-Fi built in right away. And, of course, it doesn't have gigabit Ethernet, which I was surprised. But then I realized the use case for that is, you know, if even 1080p video would not even saturate that. So what's the point of putting in gigabit Ethernet?
Yeah. I had a bit of a fail today in school because it was the last period of the day and, you know, kids had been sort of knocking my door all day going, when am I getting iOS 7? So I said, right, okay, everybody, let's just hit the button and then we'll keep going with the lesson while that all downloads. And then stupidly my lesson was to basically put my iPad on Apple TV and start showing some Google Drive stuff. And then, you know, 2 minutes into the lesson, the whole thing just ground to a complete failure because obviously everybody's iPad was just caning the network trying to get iOS 7. And I couldn't actually get my traffic through to the Apple TV properly to do the lesson. So,
oh, a caching server would have been nice.
A caching server would have been nice. I have set one up. Obviously, I haven't done very many Apple or any app updates to show that it's working or not. But I hope that over the next few days that will be... that will start to warm up a little bit and start working for us.
But yeah, it looks like Casper 9.1 was you know, nice update. Obviously, still running on Amazon EC2.
Yep, we've still got it up there. We're now that we're into steady state running. I mean, in the earlier show we talked about this, I put it up to a medium size instance, which was more than enough for sort of day to day operations. So I rolled it back down to a small, which is one step above micro, the smallest level. And I've left it there, and it seems to be running pretty happily there for now. So it seems to be working fine. And we're just kind of getting practice with it, building up those profiles, pushing them out, and so on. It's working great.
Great. Yeah, I think it'll be interesting as you go out the year, maybe at the end of the year, if you could document some of that stuff, because I think that'd be great for another school, you know, not wanting to, you know, buy a Mac Pro or a Mac Mini or some other Linux server to put, you know, their MDM on, like, you know, document how that kind of worked with Amazon. And, you know, during these periods of your school, your kind of busier periods, you might want to have this server, then you can ratchet it back down and save this kind of money. It's be great information.
Yeah, I'm indebted to there was somebody else who wrote this up a little bit, but the other blog that I read was basically talking about it from a point of view of managing Macs, and they were pointing out all the parts of the Casper system that don't work that well, or at least didn't under Casper 8, didn't work that well when they were hosted off your network. Whereas I think there are some stuff in Casper 9 that I haven't looked at because it's Mac related and not iOS related, that now allows you to do more of it off your network and in the cloud, which is pretty cool. So, it's been a big week. There's more to say about iOS 7 features in school. I guess one other thing we should probably talk about just right away, Bradley, is the activation lock issue.
Yes.
Because I've already seen some companies who do recycling of iOS devices, you know, buying them back from you to sell on the used market or whatever. You know, big banners on their website saying, if you're sending in an iOS 7 device, here's the steps you must do before you send it to us. And it's basically procedure for taking off the activation lock. And I think this is something that schools are going to have to be pretty careful with, because particularly if you do in a personalized model and kids are signing in with an Apple ID that they control, and when iOS 7 comes down, basically, it's not really optional that activation lock gets enabled. It does get enabled if you're using an Apple ID on the device. So I haven't yet tested the exact procedure for how to what you have to undo to get it off the device. But I'm going to have do some work on that this week. And I think you basically have to have the student there and able to, you know, if you don't know their iCloud password, which in many cases you won't, you have to basically get them to disable it all in front of you before they leave the school, which is fine as long as they leave the school under controlled conditions. But sometimes, you know, you get a situation where kids move away suddenly or whatever, or just stop coming back to school, and you may end up with an iPad that you can't necessarily reactivate without a password that you don't know. So there's going to have to be some procedure around that, and I'm not exactly sure what that's going to be like yet, but we'll do some work on that and see.
Yes we will. Of course, hopefully most people aren't trading in. Well, no, I guess they could be, I guess, because if you have like an old iPad that's running iOS 7 today and you trade it in towards a new iPad that's coming out presumably in less than a month, then you could have that issue.
You absolutely could. Yep. And I think as far as I can tell from the what I've read and have not tried any of it, that you sort of have to go and delete the iCloud account before you erase the device, and then you do the full reset, and then that should be it, good to go. But I'll test that, and I'll try and document it as well. See where we get to with that. All right, that's all I've got to talk about. Bradley, is there anything else we want to mention?
Oh, one last thing. If you use Evernote on the Mac, which I know you and I both do, there's a new update that adds some cool new features. My favorite is if you right-click on a note, you can convert it to a PDF right there on the spot. So I wrote about that on my blog, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
I must update that. I have not done the Mac update yet. Excellent. Big week for software. Very
exciting. Yes, it is. Yes, yep. It is.
And it's great to see how some apps have really, really taken advantage of iOS 7 already, and I look forward to, you know, obviously people are going to get feedback on that. They're going to make another pass at some of this stuff, but I'm pretty happy that most of my key apps are now looking a little more lightweight and a little more airy than they were before, and I look forward to seeing what other people come up with.
Yeah, absolutely. It's. If you're a software developer, this is when you kind of get a fresh start. If you missed out on customers buying your competitors, this is, you know, if you're first with a new design for iOS 7, then it's kind of like second chance.
It is, and it'll be interesting to see what new functionality gets unlocked. I mean, supporting the background updates is great, don't get me wrong, but that's kind of something that, in some ways, that's the way it should have always worked. If battery life and so on had allowed it in the past, which it didn't, which is why it didn't work that way. But it'll be interesting to see what new features are available. I haven't yet played with AirDrop in school. I want to get into some, now that I've got some kids who've actually got iOS 7 up and running on their devices, I want to start testing that a little bit in school and seeing what the impact of that is. But I think that's going to be a huge, huge thing for schools. And obviously there's obvious things that you would do with it, like, you know, sending photos and videos back and forth. But I'm looking forward to seeing some people come up with new ways to use AirDrop, new things that you could send around that you might not have thought of before. I haven't thought of any examples, so I can't suggest anything, but it'll be good to see what people come up with.
Well, you know, Evernote, the new version of Evernote supports it, and so you can think of how that could change your workflow. If typically you had to have some sort of like intermediate app that the students would use to turn in their assignment to get it to another app, you know, if you're using, Pages, and Pages supports AirDrop, you know, instead of having to save that to Google Drive and share it with a teacher, you can literally just AirDrop it to your teacher on your way out the door.
Yeah, when I was in South Africa, a lot of schools in South Africa are very constrained for bandwidth, and that's one thing I was heavily kind of trailing to them was, look, when iOS 7 comes out and AirDrop becomes a thing, then you can do big device-to-device file transfer without having to go to your cloud service, whatever that is, whether it's SkyDrive or Google Drive or Dropbox or whatever, and eating up some of your bandwidth. You can just do those transfers inside the network. And I think that's going to be quite attractive to a lot of schools. So, shall we leave it there for now?
I think so. Right at an hour. So I think it's a good place to call it a day.
Yeah. There have been some long podcasts coming out this week. People have got a lot to say. But I'm looking forward to testing a bit more first. And we'll talk in some depth about what we learn about that over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. So where can people find these little blog posts that we've been talking about? I'm at spears.org, SPEIRS.org. Bradley, where are you at?
Chambersdaily.com. And all the links we talked about will be on the show notes at outofschool.net.
Okay. So until next week, Bradley.
Have a good week, everybody.
You too.